Hi, I'm Ruby from Fitzroy Primary, and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
Yes, and you're back with Annie on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're moving on. We're going to listen, we're going to talk about Palazzo di Cozzo with the writer-director of a film that's coming out next week in all good cinemas. G'day, Madeline. How are you?
Good, thanks, Annie.
Oh, it's a great film.
Thank you.
Yeah, must have taken a lot of... I mean, tell us first about how you became inspired to make a film that documents the life of Franco Cozzo.
Well, I guess it was just one of those sort of light bulb moments. I sort of was driving past the huge showroom in Footscray, you know, pretty imposing presence at the end of Barclay Street there, and I guess I sort of clicked. Like, I thought, why had no one told his story before? But I guess what sort of drew the eye as a filmmaker was, you know, that image of that showroom with all that Baroque furniture in the windows, sort of just sitting there like a time capsule almost. And I think that's what really did appeal to me, sort of looking at it through the prism of this historical context and trying to understand why Franco Cozzo became this pop culture icon, but also what his sort of aesthetic means and how it related to, I guess, migrant culture more generally in Melbourne and in Australia.
Yeah, and noting your surname, Mattaniello, your parents are also part of this diaspora?
Yeah, so my dad's parents, they migrated here. In the same year as Franco Cozzo, actually. So they're Southern Italian post-war migrants, who came here in the 50s. So obviously there was also that sort of, you know, curiosity on my part, I suppose, to sort of also understand, I guess, my heritage as well. And I sort of had... you know, it really helped me form the relationship with Franco because there was that sort of shared cultural understanding, I think.
Yeah, yeah, no, I think it's a really incredibly important element in the film because, I mean, he is a testimony to all of the multicultural elements and the migrant fight for a position in a very Anglo, closed world, you'd say.
Yeah, yeah, no, of course. I mean, like, 50s Australia was a pretty homogenous place. Like, of course, we'd have migrants, you know, for decades before that. But I guess the post-war migration boom was the time when there was such an influx that it really... changed the makeup of Australia's population in a big way, like it hadn't happened before, and so of course it's sort of, you know, the age old fight with every migrant wave and continues even today with new migrants. And so yeah, he really, I think, part of the reason he became who he was and became so well known is because he really made a splash because he was so different to what I guess mainstream Australia was used to, and his aesthetic, his persona was really different and really, I guess, confusing on the one hand, but also engaging for people.
Yeah, that's interesting because actually I think previous history, white Australian history, is a very strong lie in the sense that, I mean, even in my family, I mean, in 1880, one of my ancestors is an Italian, right? And there were people who came from Bavaria, right, who are also in my family line. And it seems to me that Australia was a melting pot, but white Australia was a melting pot, but the establishment, Anglo establishment, just had a very sort of draconian, tight reign. And what seems to come out of this Franco Cozzo picture is that the Italian onslaught, and, you know, there were other nationalities as well, was so strong that, and he stood on TV, he was such a masterful showman, that it, despite his faltering English, he refused to be suppressed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that that's the fact that he, you know, spoke in his ads in Italian, and also in Greek. Like, even today, I think that would be kind of bizarre, you know? Like, I think we sort of take it for granted in Melbourne because, you know, everyone knows the ads and knows he speaks in Italian. But it was a big deal to go on, television in and speak in another language, and like you said, not be ashamed of it, and not hide, and not be ashamed of his poor English skills. Like, you know, he goes on the Don Lane show, and he actually makes fun of his own, you know, poor English, and that
it's fantastic.
He's quite self aware in terms of that that part of his, I guess,
strategy.
Persona. Like, he actually, he turns it around, and it's actually becomes an advantage for him to, you know, have this sort of eccentric way of pronouncing, you know, Footscray and Brunswick. And so it actually ends up working for him in this quite, I guess, at a time when, you know, Australia was still pretty prejudiced towards Europeans.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like Wogs at Work, isn't it? It's owning disparity. You know, the insult.
Yeah, and so they come after Franco. But yeah. I feel like he paved the way for that second generation of, you know, European migrants to start sort of looking back at their parents, and, you know, that second generation have like a different identity because they've grown up in Australia, but they've been raised by, you know, people who've come from other cultures, and they can start to sort of make fun of, but also, yeah, like you said, own that Italian or Greek or Macedonian background in a different way.
It's also fascinating too, of course, that, I mean, they're all, he's from southern Italy and from Sicily. So, I mean, I'm Australian Anglo. I mean, you know, Mo, I'm more complicated than that. But the point is, I'm not from Italy. But if you go to Italy, you understand that there's a whole range of political and cultural and almost internally racist attitudes to different regions, right? That'd be fair to say.
Yeah, definitely. No, there's a big divide between the north and the south.
Yeah.
And the south is historically the more, I guess, working class, peasant.
Mm. Poor.
Background. And poor. And also...
And exploited.
Exploited by the north for their labour. And also, there's a racial kind of prejudice there because the south... is, I think Berlusconi was said to say that the below Rome is like almost part of Africa. Like there's this like quite racist perception of the South too, even just within Italy itself.
So I suppose when people were relocating to Australia and then having a love affair with the Baroque ornate furniture. Once they came to Australia, this would have been quite a dream come true. That's what he was tapping into, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, like the people who became his customers in his heyday were, you know, all the new migrants basically, and so, you know, most of them wouldn't have been able to buy this furniture at home, and so they've come to a new country and they have, you know, worked really hard and put money aside slowly. And, you know, one of the things a lot of them decide they want to spend their money on was, you know, Franco Cozzo furniture. And it really, I guess, you know, on the one hand, it was a sign to them, I guess, of having, you know, achieved what they had come to this country for, which is, you know, being able to set up a home in the image that they wanted it to be. And, like, I don't want to make it seem like it was just, like, a materialistic goal.
No, I was going to say, it's more, wasn't it? It was much more.
It's a lot deeper than that. It's more, I think, about creating a space that, you know, has, you know,
It's the loneliness too and the loss of culture, I guess, coming here. I mean,
well, exactly. So that's like a connection to home for them as well. And, I mean, you know, it's been well documented, but, you know, for migrants it's always, you know, there's always one foot back home and one foot in the new culture. So,
and then you become a little bit lost, don't you?
Yes. So
neither nor. What is it? Whatever that is.
Living in that in-between.
Yeah. You must have done a lot of research. I mean, yes, you've got personal history, but one, there's the actual documenting of his life, his individual life, but there must have been broader things that you were looking into as well. I mean, it's a very solid film, I'd have to say.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, of course, there's that migration history, but I was also really interested in the history of TV in Australia because, you know, he actually came to Australia in 1956, which is the year that television also arrived. And so his sort of journey is in parallel with, you know, TV, and which is now, you know, obviously on the decline and changing. But that mainstream broadcast TV was really what allowed him to become so well known. And so, yeah, I was quite interested in why and how he sort of managed to use that brand new medium, because he also, like, he started the first non-English speaking TV show.
The Variety Show. I know, I didn't even know that. That was fascinating.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing. Like, he produced it, and it was a variety show with Italian, young Italian migrants singing Italian songs. And once again, you know, SBS didn't exist at this time. There was no sort of, quote, ethnic programming. He just, you know, realised that he loved music, but I think it was also another advertising campaign for him. And he had this half-hour show on for 3 years on Channel Zero, which became Channel 10. And it was all in Italian. And so, once again, you know, people at home, mainstream, Anglo-Australia would have been able to turn on the TV and it would have been there playing, and it was a window into another culture that hadn't been in the mainstream media before.
Yeah, yeah, the fantastic pieces of choices in your pieces of footage, archival footage, but also the beautiful links, the music. The music's great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I had a lot of fun with the music. It's there's a wide variety in there, but I guess I just wanted it to reflect, I guess, the energy of Franco and his story. And obviously music is quite related to him as well, because he started that music show, but then he's also been the focus of a couple of songs as well. Like, there was a song written in the 80s about him, which actually did really well and became really well known. And we've got the writer of the song, Tony Curcio, in the film, sort of reflecting on that journey for him writing that song. And then, you know, there's this even band today, there's a young band called Franco Grosso. and there's a great song by a band called The Argeteers called I Want to Die in a Franco Cozzo Bed. So,
oh, fantastic. I wish I'd got that for the show. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. So he's attracted, like, a lot of musical, I guess, interpretation too.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the device of going to people's places, like a set, a TV set of people's houses where they're in love with that furniture and they've created a whole environment. That was such a great idea. Because I've always wondered, how could you do it? You know, like, you know, where does it fit?
Now you know how people incorporate it into their home. But I guess that was something I wanted to do from the very beginning. Like, that was part of my original idea, to not just make it about Franco, but to broaden it out and to sort of, have a look into people's homes, because I think, you know, like I said, it's not just the material purchase. It also has a lot more meaning to the people who own it. And so I wanted to hear their stories too. But I loved going into the homes. That was one of my favourite parts.
Oh, it's fantastic. You wrote it, so you must have really... And how long did it take you to make this film? Because it's a challenge, I would have thought.
Yes, all filmmaking is a challenge, and, you know, documentaries notoriously take a long time to make because you're working in the real world with real people. But this one was about 4 years all up, from the day I walked into Franco's store and pitched the idea to him, and to, I guess, you know, that last day in the edit suite. So quite a long time.
Yeah, quite a long time. But also, you weren't the only person who thought it was a good idea. There's quite a few people, Screen Australia, Film Victoria, Shamil Films, the ABC, everybody was on your side. They really wanted to hear about Franco Kotzer.
Yeah, I think, you know, it took a couple of years to raise the money to make the film. But I think, yeah, at the end of the day, you know, people understood that this was a story that, you know, wasn't just a hyper local story. It had, you know, more universal themes that would appeal to people beyond Melbourne, and, you know, sort of stand on its own as a story about, you know, a pretty bold character who had a pretty unique position in Australian history, I guess.
Yeah, it's opening next week, and it's going to be at the Nova Yarraville Sun. Palace Pentridge. I always the whole idea of a cinema at Pentridge is so funny. Lido Hawthorne Classic, Elsternwick, and Cameo Belgrave. So you can go and see it and enjoy it as much as I did. Thanks for talking to me, Madeline.
Oh, thank you so much, Annie. It's been lovely.